Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's brand new day disinfecting wipes conveniently tackle surfaces, including remotes, tablets, and smartphones, killing 99.9% of viruses and bacteria with a fragrance that feels like a tropical getaway for your senses. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey everyone, welcome to another installment of the summer series we're calling the OFH Throwbacks. This week's throwback episode is one that I've been looking forward to for a long time. Now, I get asked all the time what my favorite episode of Our Fake History has been over the past 5 seasons. Now, all these shows are my babies, so I really do love them all. But if I had to pick, it might be the series on who invented rock and roll. Now, there are other episodes in the canon that might be better executed or funnier or include some novel research, but this is the one that I had the most fun researching personally. Now, I talk about this a lot in the show, but I'm a bit of a music geek. The history of rock and roll is something I really care about, and I think you hear it in my voice in these episodes. The research for these shows also took me into some unexpected places, and I uncovered songs and artists that were unknown even to me, someone who'd been looking at the history of rock for, you know, most of my life. So I think there are things in this series that will surprise even dedicated students of the history of rock and roll. But despite my love of this series, I was always disappointed in myself for not including clips of the music I was referencing. At the time, I was really worried I was going to get sued. Instead, I directed listeners to a playlist on YouTube that they could listen along with, and some helpful OFH listeners out there also made a Spotify playlist that I think you can still find. But I always thought the show would be better if you could hear the clips from the songs in real time as you were listening to the show. Well, eventually I was assured by legal minds more astute than my own that using short clips for the purposes of education or criticism falls within what's known as fair use. In other words, you can use a little clip without getting sued if you use it the right way. So I created a redux version of the shows that I released to my patrons a few years back. Well, now, finally, everyone who follows the show will get to hear these shows with the music. So these are the Sebastian Major director's cut versions of these shows, and honestly, I think they are way better than the originals. I can't wait for you to hear this. Finally, over the past few months, there's been a renewed discussion around the experience and history of Black people in the United States and around the world. I hope this series can contribute thoughtfully to that discussion. In many ways, this series explores the phenomenon of Black erasure, which is a term I didn't use at the time, but if I was making the show today, I probably would use it. In this case, I look at how the artistic contributions of Black people have often been overlooked or erased in the history of rock and roll. It's kind of astounding how often essential Black artists have been left out of this story. I mean, this is rock and roll. You cannot tell the story without talking about Black people. One of the goals of this podcast was to take on the myth that Elvis Presley invented rock and roll in 1954 and highlight the contributions of the many artists who came before him, most of whom were Black. I would also like to dedicate the re-release of this series to the memory of the great Little Richard, the self-proclaimed architect of rock and roll, who we lost earlier this year. The world's just a little less colorful without you, Richard. Rest in peace. So please enjoy part one of Who Invented Rock and Roll. We will be re-releasing part two in 2 weeks' time, so please check back in with us then. All right, enjoy the show. On an August morning in 1953, a truck driver walked into a small recording studio in Memphis, Tennessee. He was looking to make a record. In those days, little independent recording studios were quite familiar with these types of walk-ins. These studios were not solely the domain of professional musicians. People often wanted to record songs or even spoken word messages as gifts for friends and family. Anyone could come in off the street, sing a little something, and have a cheap record pressed on the spot. This helped these nascent studios drum up a little extra cash. And who knows, someone talented just might end up walking through your front door. Just to hammer home their open-door policy, this particular recording studio's motto was, "We'll record anything, anywhere, anytime." This truck driver would later claim that he came in that day to make a record as a birthday gift for his mother. But it turns out that was a little bit of a white lie. His mother's birthday had been a couple months previous. He just wanted to see how he sounded. Now, over the course of a few short takes, the young man recorded a couple of unremarkable country-inflected ballads. There was nothing particularly special about the songs themselves, but there was something about this young man that caught the attention of Marion Keisker, the woman who was running the shop that day. The kid was striking to look at, and he had this distinctive baritone voice. She made a note of his name and added her own little touch of commentary in her notes. She wrote, "Elvis Presley, good ballad singer, hold." Over the course of the next year, Marion Keisker couldn't seem to get this young man out of her head. Her boss was a man by the name of Sam Phillips, who was the owner of this little studio and also the head producer. He had dubbed his little storefront Sun Studios, and by 1953, he had recorded dozens of artists, many of whom would go on to be hugely important to American music. Blues legends B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf had both launched their careers cutting records at Phillips' studio. But in the year after that truck driver first recorded those two syrupy ballads, Marion Keisker just kept bringing him up to Phillips. She was constantly saying things like, "When are you going to do something with that kid with the sideburns?" In early July of 1954, Phillips finally took Keisker's advice and got a hold of the young man with the unusual name. On the 4th of July, Elvis came over to Phillips' house. Apparently, he was wearing a pink shirt with black trim and had just a hint of eye makeup on. In Tennessee in 1954, that was a pretty weird look for a young man. But luckily for Elvis, Phillips was attracted to weirdos. However, the music that Elvis wanted to make was anything but weird. He wanted to be a crooner, and so that night they set about arranging a couple of ballads for him to sing the next day at the studio. His performances were solid, but everyone present seemed to agree that they were nothing special. The next day in the studio, Elvis was paired with two local musicians named Scotty Moore and Bill Black. After a few hours trying to nail down the ballads that they'd rehearsed, everyone was feeling pretty uninspired. Elvis was okay, but there was nothing particularly special happening. So they decided to take a break. The crew lit up cigarettes, and some people even left the studio to grab a snack. Elvis, on the other hand, decided to stay in the studio, where he picked up a guitar and started goofing around. He started strumming a blues number that he'd heard on one of the few Memphis radio stations that played music by black artists. It was Arthur Big Boy Crudup's That's All Right Mama. But Elvis was playing it fast, almost comically fast. Scotty Moore jumped in and started goofing around with Elvis. That's when Sam Phillips' ears perked up. He poked his head through the studio door and said, "Hey, what are you boys doing in there?" Elvis just looked at Scotty, shrugged, and said, "Well, we don't know." "Well, hold on," said Phillips, getting behind the mixing board. "Try and do it again." The musicians set up, and the result was magic.
"Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right.
Elvis's cover of this blues song was infused with a country twang and a youthful energy that seemed brand new. Rock writer Grail Marcus would later say that Elvis had, quote, "turned a lament for a lost love into a satisfied declaration of independence," end quote. The sound that flowed out of Elvis subconsciously in that moment, that countrified take on American blues music, that was something new. That was rock and roll. Or so goes the myth. That day in Sun Studios, July 5th, 1954, has since been celebrated as the official birthday of rock and roll. Now, there's no doubting that That's All Right Mama was a huge record, both musically and culturally. But was that really the beginning? Was rock and roll just something that tumbled out of Elvis Presley by accident? Or had this sound been in the air for years before this bashful truck driver wandered into Sun Studios? Just how new was Elvis's sound in 1954? Well, it turns out this question is one of the most controversial in American pop culture. Identifying the starting point of any musical genre is always fraught with peril. How exactly do you pinpoint the moment when one art form completes its mutation into another? I mean, this might be a fool's errand, but on that errand we must go. After all, if Elvis Presley didn't invent rock and roll, then who did? This is our fake history. Episode number 53, Who Invented Rock and Roll, Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major and this is the podcast where we look at historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week we are diving into a topic that I have wanted to explore for quite some time, the birth of rock and roll music. Now, as many of you have probably put together by now, I'm a bit of a music obsessive. In fact, I come from a whole family of music nerds. If you go to my parents' house, you'll notice that they have pictures of the Beatles up where other people would have pictures of their family up. It's like, oh, look, there's Uncle Ringo. My mom can sing every lyric to pretty much any song that was on the radio from like 1965 to 1975. And that includes most of the Alice Cooper catalog. My dad's Christmas card is just a list of his top 15 albums from that year, complete with album art and selected annotations, of course. So I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, because music is a pretty huge part of my life. Not only do I dabble as an amateur musician, but I'm also a dedicated record collector and a lifelong student of the history of popular music. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Well, when it comes to this topic, I feel more emotionally involved than usual. Rock and roll, it's something that I really care about. Now, I really hope that my status as a super fan doesn't cloud my judgment when it comes to the question of who invented rock and roll music. Now, this particular topic is especially thorny because you're often put in this position as an investigator where you have to apply your own personal smell test to a case that's being made. As always, I've been guided to my conclusions by reading the experts on the topic and doing my research, but this topic just has way more room for personal opinion to creep in. So for this one, I'm going to encourage you to do just a touch of your own research so you can draw your own conclusions. Now, don't worry, this isn't some crazy homework assignment. All you have to do is listen to some awesome music. To help with this, I'm going to have a link to a playlist that I've created on YouTube that features all of the music that I'm going to be talking about. You can find that link in a few places. It will be in the description of the show. It'll be on the page for the episode at ourfakehistory.com, and it will be posted on the Facebook page. So whenever you're listening to this, you can always find that link to my YouTube playlist. When you get a chance, please go listen to the songs. It's a helpful companion to this series of episodes. And yes, this is going to be a two-parter. I've got a lot to say about this. Okay, in general, rock and roll is awash in mythology. It's part of what makes it so much fun. So it should probably come as no surprise that the birth of the genre comes with its own unique collection of creation myths. Mythology seems to develop even better than usual when it comes to pop culture topics. There tends to be this unstated feeling among writers that when the subject is entertainment, it's perfectly acceptable to play a little more fast and loose with the facts. A great story gets picked up and repeated with even less second-guessing or investigation than usual. Let me put it this way. If you were a journalist in the 1950s and someone told you a crazy story about Ike Eisenhower, you might do some fact-checking. But if you heard a colorful yarn about, say, Little Richard, well, no biggie. That one might just go right to print. Mountains of books have been written about rock and roll as an idea, a movement, an ideology, and a cultural force. As the soundtrack of the baby boomer generation, rock and roll may just be one of the most celebrated musical forms ever. I mean, the baby boomers really know how to throw themselves a party. Look no further than the shining glass pyramid on the shores of Lake Erie that calls itself the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for evidence of the genre's importance in American culture, and world culture for that matter. Now, whether or not you are personally a fan of rock music is somewhat irrelevant when you consider its place in the 20th century. Love it or hate it, you have to reckon with rock and roll. I'm sure that many of you out there are familiar with the little truism that the 20th century was the quote-unquote American century. This is the idea that the 1900s were defined by America's rise to power. When the century ended, the United States stood virtually unchallenged as the world's only superpower. Not only was America militarily dominant, but it was also culturally dominant. The world was hungry for American movies, American clothes, and of course, American music. When it comes to music, there are a few forms that are completely and unambiguously indigenous to the United States, and those are jazz, the blues, country and western, and, of course, rock and roll. Some have argued that rock and roll, which is essentially the child of those earlier styles, is the most American of American musics. There was even once an idea out there that just by listening to rock and roll, you would be immediately seduced by American culture. During the Cold War, the French philosopher Régis Darbray commented that there was, quote, more power in blue jeans and rock and roll than the entire Red Army, end quote. By that he meant that the American way of life was so innately attractive that no amount of military force could keep people living behind the Iron Curtain from desiring it. I think it's telling that Darbray used rock and roll as an easy metaphor for everything that is exciting and seductive about the United States. When people heard it, it not only moved them to dance or party, it also moved them to create. You wanted to start your own band and put your own spin on the sound. Rap music might be the only other musical form since that has been embraced internationally in the same way and has inspired so many different local variations. In that way, rock and roll might just be the best American invention. Sorry, the light bulb. Move over, the airplane. I officially crown rock and roll as the best thing invented in the United States. Okay, so if you accept my somewhat outlandish premise that rock and roll music is the best American invention, then that raises the question, who invented it? Well, some might say that the question itself is flawed, that it's nearly impossible to point to any one artist or band who should get the credit for the creation of an entire genre. And, you know, that's probably true. Yet, we keep on returning to this question. Different figures are constantly being put forward as rock and roll's definitive inventor. I personally was emboldened to take on this question when I saw the title of Peter Guralnick's 2015 biography of Sun Studios founder Sam Phillips. Guralnick is widely recognized as having written some of the best popular histories of American roots music. His books on the blues, soul, and his two-volume biography of Elvis are some of the best researched available. Now, interestingly enough, Guralnick titled his 2015 biography, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Now, we can and will debate whether or not that title is justified, but it goes to show that even as recently as 2015, the question of who invented rock and roll was still potent enough to move books off of shelves. I figured if someone as respected as Peter Guralnick could put out a candidate for inventor of rock and roll in 2015, then the question itself wasn't so ridiculous. So if we were to head out on the street and ask people who they thought invented rock and roll, I'm guessing most of our respondents would probably just shrug. You might bump into the rare music nerd who would give you a long, convoluted answer. But most people, if they could give you an answer at all, would probably respond with just one word. Elvis. There's this idea in popular culture that Elvis Presley wasn't just the king of rock and roll, he was also the inventor of the style. The myth got its start because for many white Americans, Elvis was not only their first exposure to rock and roll music, but also their first exposure to the sounds that had been developing in Black America for quite some time. If you hadn't been paying attention to the music being made by African Americans, then Elvis truly did seem like he'd come from another planet. Now, people living in segregated 1950s America can potentially be forgiven for their ignorance, but historians of the genre should not be. You see, in 2004, Rolling Stone magazine declared that it was officially rock and roll's 50th birthday. How did they determine that? Well, the good people at Rolling Stone used July 5th, 1954 as the official starting point of the genre. As we said in the intro, that was the day that Elvis Presley recorded That's All Right Mama with Sam Phillips at Sun Studios. Rolling Stone used that charming story about Elvis serendipitously stumbling upon a new sound as their line in the sand. And also, the fact that it's right around the 4th of July kind of links it to America's independence, and oh boy, it just works too well as a myth. Now, even though they didn't say this explicitly, it was implied that everything that came before the summer of 1954 was not rock and roll, and everything that came after it was. The fact that this came from Rolling Stone magazine was no small thing. Since the late 60s, they had been promoting themselves as the world's best source of rock and roll journalism. Love 'em or hate 'em, when it came to rock, Rolling Stone was the paper of record. For them to so unambiguously pin the beginning of rock and roll to Elvis, well, this was kind of a big deal. For the readers of Rolling Stone, the Elvis myth had now become history. Now, the outcry over this came fast and furious. Those annoyed by Rolling Stone's privileging of Elvis were even more outraged by the accompanying promotional campaign run by Miller Lite Beer. In partnership with Rolling Stone, the beer company was going to be issuing 8 special commemorative cans. Each can would be emblazoned with the face of a great rocker from the past 50 years. Of course, Elvis got a can, as did Alice Cooper, the Eagles' Joe Walsh, and Blondie's Debbie Harry. But not a single can featured an African-American artist. No Little Richard, no Chuck Berry, not even a Jimi Hendrix. Many black people felt like Rolling Stone and Miller Lite had written them out of their own history. I mean, honestly, how could you tell the story of rock and roll without black people? These frustrations were perhaps best summed up by the legendary rock and roll and soul singer Lloyd Price, who had this to say to the New York Sun in 2004. He said, quote, "Rolling Stone is making money off of this hype. They have an advertising deal with Miller Beer. And Miller Beer put 7 white musicians on beer cans and no blacks and said these are the founders of rock and roll. I knew Elvis. He did great things for the music. He never called himself the founder of rock and roll. This is media history, not real history. Rolling Stone started in 1967. So how can they say who started rock and roll in 1954? The fact is that Fats Domino sold more records than Elvis between 1953 and 1956. I mean, I loved Elvis, but it's a lie to say that he invented anything." End quote. Whew. That's what I call throwing down the gauntlet. Lloyd Price, in no uncertain terms, accused Rolling Stone of propagating fake history. So, that's where I come in. If Lloyd Price is right, and it's a lie to say that Elvis invented anything, then where should we draw our line in the sand? Well, to answer that question, we first need to define our terms. What is rock and roll anyway? Well, let's check it out. So, what actually makes something rock and roll? Well, there's a million different ways you can answer that question. Is it an idea? Is it an attitude? Or is it an identifiable sound? Well, in reality, it's all of those things. If you think of rock and roll as an attitude, then there's really no end to your potential starting points. Some have tried to make the case that virtuoso violinist Paganini was kind of rock and roll. After all, it was rumored that when he really started to shred his arpeggios, the devil could be glimpsed peeking over his shoulder. That sounds pretty rock and roll. And of course, there's the great Robert Johnson, who we've explored on this podcast before. In many ways, his haunting style of Delta blues provided the blueprint for the genre, and his mysterious life was the epitome of the rock and roll myth. He did die at the age of 27, after all.
I got stones in my pathway, and my road seem dark at night. I got stones in my pathway, and my road seem dark at night. I have pains in my heart, they have taken my appetite.
But here's the thing. If we go in that direction, then anything and everything with a rebellious attitude can be defined as rock and roll, and that really doesn't get us anywhere. So for the purposes of this show, we're going to say that rock and roll is a sound. Now, what is that sound? Well, all of the experts seem to agree that rock and roll is the great coming together of white and black American musical forms. Rock and roll is rooted in the 12-bar structure of the blues, but it's inflected with elements from bluegrass, country, jazz, and both white and black gospel traditions. But perhaps the most defining thing in the sound was the beat. This was a driving, propulsive big beat. Instead of the jazz swinging beat, which liked to accentuate the two and the four, which kind of went one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, was swinging, two, three, four. Rock and roll liked to hit every one of those quarter notes, the one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. This was commonly called the backbeat. Now, I know, as rock and roll evolved through the ages, eventually the sound would broaden to include all sorts of crazy stuff. But that's generally where it began. That combination of blues, jazz, and country with that driving beat anchoring it. Now, because rock and roll is such a rich broth of musical influences, finding the exact moment or the precise recording where all of the elements come together just right, well, that can be difficult. Not impossible, but tricky. Finding the first rock and roll recording has a lot to do with feel, and that's part of why there are so many potential contenders. We all feel the music slightly differently. Nevertheless, thoughtful observers have still managed to make good cases for a number of logical starting points. So aside from the sound of rock and roll, we also need to consider more broadly how genres get their names. We need to ask, when was the term rock and roll first used to describe a particular style of music? Well, amazingly, we actually know the answer to that question. You see, the term rock and roll existed as slang in African-American communities for decades before it ever became associated with music. What did it mean, you ask? Well, rock and roll meant sex. Rockin' and rollin' was having sex. The first known musical reference to that slang term comes from way back in 1922. The vaudeville actress and jazz singer Trixie Smith had a particularly scandalous number called My Baby Rocks Me With One Steady Roll. I'll give you one guess what that song was about. Here's a little sample of the lyrics. Quote, "My man rocks me with one steady roll. There's no slipping once he takes hold. I look at the clock and the clock struck one. I said, now daddy, ain't we got fun? He kept rocking with one steady roll."
My man rocks me with one steady roll. There's no slipping when he once takes hold. I looked at the clock and the clock struck one. I said, now, daddy, ain't we got fun? He kept rocking with one steady roll.
So she was basically the Nicki Minaj of her day. Now, even though this was the first time the terms rock and roll were put together in music, we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves here. This is not yet rock and roll music. If you go back and listen to that track, you'll find that it's this slithering 1920s jazz number. It's very cool, but it doesn't rock. So, if Trixie Smith was the first person to put rock and roll in music, then who was the first person to use that term in reference to a specific genre? Well, that was a DJ from Cleveland, Ohio named Alan Freed. Freed got his start hosting a classical music show, but in the summer of 1951, he started a new show with a very different programming prerogative. His show was called The Moondog House, and on it he played up-tempo jazz numbers, electric blues, swing, and a music that was now being known as rhythm and blues. The story goes that Freed first heard the term rock and roll from a black coworker. Apparently, Freed asked the man what he was up to that night, and his friend replied, "Tonight I'm rocking and rolling." Freed really liked that little turn of phrase and thought that it perfectly described the party-themed music he was playing on his show. From then on in, he called the Moondog House a rock and roll show. So in those early days, if Alan Freed played your record on the air, then you were rock and roll. But there are some reasons to doubt Freed's story about his discovery of the term. In the late 40s, there were a ton of records that used the term rock and roll in their lyrics. There was Roy Brown's Good Rockin' Tonight, which declared, "Have you heard the news? There's good rockin' tonight." There was Louis Jordan's Saturday Night Fish Fry. The chorus to that song just went, "It was rockin'," again and again and again. There was Wynonie Harris's All She Wants to Do Is Rock. And Wild Bill Moore had a popular song that was literally called We're Gonna Rock, We're Gonna Roll.
All night long, we're gonna rock, we're gonna roll, 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 we're gonna rock, we're gonna roll.
Now, all of these records were exactly the kind of music that Alan Freed would have been playing on his show. So I find it hard to believe that he hadn't heard the term rock and roll in his records before his coworker said it to him offhand. There's a good chance that this was just a little bit of myth-making on Freed's part. As the 50s progressed and rock and roll became an unstoppable phenomenon, Alan Freed started promoting himself as Mr. Rock and Roll and, dare I say it, the inventor of the genre. If Freed had a clean origin story about the invention of the term rock and roll, it helped solidify his legacy. He needed to be the first one to apply it to music. If a musician said it first, well, that would complicate things now, wouldn't it? Now, in everything I've read about Alan Freed, no one ever points to an exact date when he first said rock and roll on the air. However, it is clear that by 1953, he was starting every show with, "All ready to rock?" So, there you go. Even though his origin story for the term is a little shady, we can still safely say that he popularized the words rock and roll. Alan Freed is also famous for hosting what is widely thought to be the first major rock and roll concert. This was the infamous Moondog Coronation Ball. It was held on March 21st, 1952 at the Cleveland Arena. Freed promoted the show on his radio program for weeks in a bid to sell as many of the 10,000 available tickets as possible. Now, he thought turnout was going to be pretty good, but Alan Freed had no idea what he was in for. On the night of the show, some 20,000 people were lined up outside clamoring to get into the event. Now, some of these people were legitimate ticket holders, some had counterfeit tickets, and others were straight-up gate crashers. Eventually, the pressure from outside got so great that the rowdy crowd busted through the doors and started streaming into the arena in droves. It was a chaotic scene, and the authorities were called immediately. The police arrived, they cleared everyone out of the arena, and the Moondog Coronation Ball was over before it started. So, this is yet another amazing origin story for rock and roll. I mean, of course the first ever rock and roll show was busted up by the cops. But I think it's important to ask who was actually supposed to play at this show. Well, it turns out the headliners were Paul Williams and his Hucklebuckers, a vocal group known as the Dominoes, and my personal favorite, Tiny Grimes and his Rockin' Highlanders. They were an all-black jazz and R&B group who sometimes played in full Scottish regalia, and that included kilts. So, if these bands were going to play at the first rock and roll concert, then it logically follows that they must be the first rock and roll bands. Well, potentially? Oddly enough, most experts don't ever seem to point to Paul Hucklebuck Williams or even the Rockin' Highlanders as the originators of the genre. You see, their sound was still deeply rooted in big band jazz and swing. Now, you could argue that the Rockin' Highlanders did have a few rock and roll songs in their catalog. 1951's Rockin' and Sockin' has an up-tempo blues bounce that puts it tantalizingly close. And 1953's Call of the Wild, with its driving beat and propulsive guitar riffs, well, to my ear, that's totally rock and roll. But here's the thing. The more I've looked into the Moondog Coronation Ball, the less convinced I've become that it was truly the first rock and roll show. First, I haven't found any strong evidence that Alan Freed was using the term rock and roll by March of 1952. The show was not advertised as a rock and roll show on any of the promotional materials. The only recording of Alan Freed's voice from the time that I could find was his on-air apology after the debacle at the Cleveland Arena. In that apology, he calls the event a dance and never once uses the term rock and roll. So it seems as though the quote-unquote first rock concert label is something that was put on the Moondog Coronation Ball after the fact. It may have not even been designated as such until years after it took place. it seems like it was given that distinction out of deference to Alan Freed's later promotion of the genre. If the bands playing the show aren't really recognized as rock and roll bands, the Highlanders' later output aside, and the promoters didn't really understand it as a rock and roll show, then why does the Moondog Coronation Ball get this spot in history? Well, it has quite a lot to do with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the city of Cleveland. You see, it was pretty controversial when Cleveland was picked as the site for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Many believed that Memphis or Chicago were more appropriate given their importance to the development of the musical genre. After all, which early bands came from Cleveland again? Well, none, really, at least in those early days. The only things that really connected Cleveland to the birth of rock and roll were Alan Freed's radio show and this alleged first concert. Now, don't get me wrong. There's no doubting that the Moondog Coronation Ball was a crazy event. The massive turnout also suggests that Freed had tapped into something in the culture. After all, people were nearly rioting to hear those bands. Still, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame itself has an interest in connecting that event to the birth of rock and roll music. They also have an interest in suggesting that Alan Freed was the inventor of the genre. Those two things help justify the existence of the hall in Cleveland. So, did Alan Freed invent rock and roll? Well, I'm going to have to go with a hard no on that one. He certainly helped popularize the term, but even that has a hazy timeline. His Moondog Coronation Ball wasn't promoted as a rock and roll show, and the bands that played weren't really rock and roll bands. In retrospect, it only fits into the history of rock and roll because of the presence of Alan Freed. Freed would go on to solidify his reputation as Mr. Rock and Roll once he moved his show to the city of New York. Also in that city, he would host a number of other events in the vein of the Moondog Coronation Ball that were promoted as rock and roll shows. The Moondog Coronation Ball fits neatly into the myth of rock and roll, a music so wild that it could start a riot. But the elevation of that event has more to do with Cleveland's claim to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame than any actual music that was played in the Cleveland Arena in 1952. But if we want to find the birthplace of rock and roll, we really shouldn't be looking to arenas anyway. Instead, we need to train our focus on the small, sweaty clubs in three of America's truly musical cities. The birth of rock and roll could potentially be seen as a tale of three cities. Those cities are New Orleans, Chicago, and Memphis. All three of these cities were instrumental in the development of the sound, and all three of them have a claim on potentially being the home of the inventor of rock and roll. So let's start with New Orleans. Now, it goes without saying that New Orleans is one of the world's greatest musical cities. It's hard to name another place that's produced so many unique musical styles. Obviously, New Orleans is most celebrated as the birthplace of jazz, but that's just the tip of a vast musical iceberg. New Orleans is truly like no other city in the United States. Its history as a French colony and its unique placement at the mouth of the Mississippi River meant that it's always been a meeting place of cultures.
not only did French and English collide there, but Latin culture and the culture of the Caribbean also had a presence. It was also one of the largest slave ports in the New World. It was often the first place that people who had been forcibly taken from Africa landed in the United States. But amazingly, despite the horrifying conditions of slavery, elements of West African culture also seeped into the local brew that was New Orleans. This diversity is perhaps best understood through the local music. Jazz combined Civil War-era marching band music with Latin, Caribbean, and West African influences to create something entirely new. But of course, the music of New Orleans didn't simply stop evolving at the turn of the century. Local music continued to mutate and grow. The constant in much of this music was its sense of celebration and dirty fun. By the late 1930s, this sound was perhaps best exemplified by the rollicking jazz pianist Jelly Roll Morton. Jelly Roll took classical music, Dixieland jazz, ragtime, and Latin rhythms, and mixed them together in this virtuosic piano-playing style. The music was fast and complex, but it's also super fun and celebratory. Check out the track Wolverine Blues on the playlist to see what I'm talking about. It doesn't rock, but it definitely rolls. However, his musical children might just be the inventors of rock and roll. The first one of these is the great Professor Longhair. Born Henry Roland Byrd in Bulgosa, Louisiana, Longhair started his life as a performer dancing for spare change on the street corners of New Orleans. He then moved on to low-level hustling and a little bit of card sharking. All the while, he was developing his chops as a piano player. Now, legend has it that the piano that the young Henry Byrd learned to play on was missing keys, which led to the development of his unique style on the instrument. He got a break in 1948 when Mike Testoir, the owner of the Caledonia Club, gave him his first steady gig. Almost immediately, this young man with the unusually shaggy hair, hence his nickname, became a bit of a local sensation. His music borrowed heavily from calypso, mambo, and rumba rhythms. The result was a much more rhythmic and danceable version of what Jelly Roll Morton was doing. By the end of the year, Professor Longhair was recording. So, a potential contender for the first ever rock and roll recording is Professor Longhair's Mardi Gras in New Orleans from 1948.
I wanna know what's carnival called.
It's built around the 12-bar blues, but it has this bumpin' Latin rhythm. It takes the blues and pushes it into a new place that's even more danceable. So is that rock and roll? Well, it's certainly cool, but you could argue that Longhair is almost a genre onto himself. He certainly pushes us closer to rock and roll, but many have pointed out that his music doesn't have that driving rock and roll beat. Oddly enough, his inventive rhythms might disqualify him as the true inventor of the genre. I mean, he definitely invented something, but it might not even have a name. However, I would argue that his direct musical descendant is unequivocally rock and roll, and that is the great Fats Domino. Antoine Dominic Domino Jr. was born and raised in the city of New Orleans. His family was French Creole. You see, back in the French colonial days, interracial marriage had been allowed. The result was a mixed-race group of people who created their own unique subculture in Louisiana. When the British and then the Americans took over the city and brought with them new laws forbidding the mixing of the races, the Creoles solidified into an identifiable group that was different from both the city's white and black populations. They even had their own language, a type of French patois known as Louisiana Creole. In fact, that was Fats' first language. All of this is to say that you don't get much more New Orleans than Fats Domino. The young Antoine started playing piano in bars around the city at the age of 14, and he very quickly became a student of all things musical in his hometown. By 1948, he had a steady gig as a piano player in a group called the Solid Senders. But all the while, he was absorbing the new sounds being produced by people like Professor Longhair. This influenced his own piano playing style, which became more percussive. He started to develop his own rolling and tumbling feel to his playing that was amazing to dance to. Fats also started to develop a reputation for putting on a pretty electric live show. He was a big man, hence the nickname Fats, but he didn't mind using his body for dramatic effect. His signature move was to use his thighs and belly to actually pick up the piano and shuffle it around the stage. Just imagine that. A big guy, nearly 250 pounds, throwing a piano around. I mean, that's pretty badass. By 1949, Fats had struck out as a solo performer and cut his first single for Imperial Records. The song was called The Fat Man and was recorded on December 10th, 1949. The song was an updated take on a blues number called Junkers Blues that was originally about heroin addicts. Fats and his Imperial Records songwriting partner decided to change the lyrics to make them a bit more accessible. They decided to make the song a lighthearted take on being big-boned. So, The Fat Man, let's consider it.
Thank you.
You could argue that in this song, all the rock and roll elements are in place. You've got that 12-bar blues structure. You've got the fast tempo. And perhaps most importantly, you've got that driving big beat. On top of that, you have this crazy vocal performance. The second verse of the song doesn't even have any lyrics. It's just Fats going, wah, 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 wah. It kind of sounds like he's imitating a trumpet with his mouth or something. It's ridiculous. But it brings the song this wonderful, carefree vibe. Go to the playlist, listen to this one, and tell me it's not rock and roll. Now, the Fat Man would go on to be a huge hit and would make Fats Domino a bit of a star. By 1951, it had sold over 1 million copies. So there's a really good case to be made that even if the Fat Man wasn't the first rock and roll song, it was most certainly the first rock and roll hit. Now, as many of you know, Fats recently left us, which has sent many writers back to his catalog to reevaluate his legacy. Randy Lewis, writing for the LA Times, offered this argument for the Fat Man as the first rock and roll song. He writes, quote, "The argument over where rock and roll began has been debated for decades, but I've long argued that well before Bill Haley and his Comets set teens hopping in 1955 with Rock Around the Clock, before Elvis first got teens quaking a year earlier with That's All Right, even before Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats weaved wicked double entendres into a rollicking rock workout called Rocket 88 in 1951, there was Antoine Fats Domino. In 1949, he recorded The Fat Man, an exuberant jumping track that has all the elements that would come to define the genre. Instead of the swinging rhythm that heavily emphasized the second and fourth beats of each measure, common to so much jump blues and R&B of the late 40s, The Fat Man was built instead on a steady, pounding beat from Domino's left hand in the lower half of the piano keyboard, pushing the song along, the driving forepulse that was the signature of rock and roll. The lyric also conveyed a sexy swagger, even though Domino didn't cut the lithe figure that Presley, Lewis, Richard, and others did, hence his nickname. Yet his celebrated girth was no impediment to his confidence in the ways of romance. They call me the Fat Man, 'cause I weigh 200 pounds. All the girls, they love me, 'cause I know my way around." End quote. So, does that settle it? Did Fats Domino invent rock and roll in 1949 and that's it? Ah, my sweet summer child, if only it was that simple. We've only explored one of the three cities I mentioned earlier. Now, hopefully by now it's clear that rock and roll wasn't born in 1954. However, this story is far from over. We need to consider the Chicago Blues, the electrification of the sound that was born in the Mississippi Delta, and we also need to reckon with the country and Western elements that would smash into black music in the city of Memphis. We haven't even talked about Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and have only just hinted at the immortal Rocket 88. Ladies and gentlemen, there is plenty more rockin' still to come. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will continue our look at the birth of rock and roll. Once again, I'll remind you that the playlist that goes along with this episode can be found at ourfakehistory.com on the page for this episode. You'll also be able to find it at the Facebook page, so that's facebook.com/ourfakehistory. And I'm going to put a link in the show description. So if you look at the description of the show, there should be a link in there that takes you right to the YouTube playlist so you can hear all this awesome music. Before we go this week, I'd like to send a shout out to Ranger Tim, David W., Tim Johnston, Shane Gordon, Tori Hunt, Sidekick 65, and Stefan. All of you have decided to support the show at $5 or more a month on Patreon. And so, you know what that means. You are beautiful human beings. Honestly, guys, I can't say thank you enough to everyone out there who is supporting the show either through Patreon at patreon.com/ourfakehistory or through one-time donations or by buying the extra shows. I hope everyone who's been supporting at $3 or more on Patreon has enjoyed the latest extra episode that I put out there. It was called More Robin Hood, and I told you just more Robin Hood stories. So I hope you liked those. Let me know. Let me know what you thought. Now, if you're someone out there that wants to support the show, but like a lot of us, you don't got the extra scratch to send some along to a podcast, then think about just writing a nice review on iTunes, Stitcher, or any podcast app that lets you review shows. The reviews help. They really do help the show. So if you want to support us for free, just go write a nice review. I appreciate them. It rules. People are always sending me messages all the time being like, oh, I'm so sorry that I can't support through Patreon. And it's okay, guys. Honestly, I get it. You got to save your money. If you got the extra money, it really helps. But if you don't, write a nice review or just send me a message. Write me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com or go to Twitter at ourfakehistory or go to the Facebook page at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. Reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I love interacting with you. I love seeing the stuff that you guys create and post on Twitter and on the Facebook page. Hey, honestly, special shout out to whoever made those hilarious Richard the Lionheart memes. I really liked those. I literally laughed out loud when I saw them. A true lol from Sebastian. So there you go. Whoever made those, you rule. Okay, that's all for this week. The theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com and check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save